Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson. Quick plugs up the top. I have a show called Will Legal. It is currently on tour. I am currently at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and then after that I am going to Canberra, Sydney, Perth, and a whole bunch of other places hopefully later in the year. But that's them for the moment. Comedy.com.au. Don't go to my website. It's totally out of date. I'm going to fix it up at some stage when I have some time. Hey, this episode is with Dave Hughes. Hughesy. Don't really have to do much of an introduction for Hughesy. He's a household name in Australia. But if you're listening from overseas, you might not know as much about Dave Hughes. Dave Hughes and I met the first day I did comedy. We were on at the same gig at the ESPY. And I have known him for the last 22, 23 years. And our careers in many ways have been quite different, but they've intersected at different times. We've worked together, and often I think that we have been people who have inspired each other in, you know, different ways. Good friends, and not somebody that I get to sit down and have this sort of conversation with all the time, though. So it was really good fun. We had an absolute ball when it happened. Dave has a show on at the Melbourne Comedy Festival and touring around. It's called The Snorkeler. Go and see it. Some people will know Hughesy is one of the people that I go out of my way to go and see, because you know that you're going to get a great night of entertainment. And I think he's one of the great stand-ups. It seems weird to say about someone who's as successful as Hughesy, but I think he's one of the great stand-ups of all time. I think sometimes, and we touch on this a little bit in the podcast, because he talks about his kids or, you know, family life or, you know, little things, that sometimes his comedy is underrated or undervalued. But I think, you know, his capacity for human understanding is, you know, anywhere between Seinfeld and, you know, Barry Humphries. He has a way of talking about the world where he can critique the world from inside the world. Most people who are critiquing the world, you know, often doing it from slightly outside that world. That's where the critique comes from. But Hughesy has an amazing capacity to be of a world and critique the world all at the same time. And I think it's amazing. It's why he, the Logies, as many people know, I hate the Logies, but the Logies, I think, is also the toughest thing to open in show business. It's a room full of show business assholes. They're more interested in themselves than they are in your jokes. And Hughesy has done it every year for the last 3 or 4 years and smashed it every year for the last 3 or 4 years. And again, I think it comes down to his great capacity of being able to be of something, but also critical of that thing. He is good at critiquing the entertainment business because he's also proudly part of the entertainment business. You can watch his TV show, Hughesy, We Have a Problem. Hughesy, I Have a Problem. Hughesy, We Have a Problem. Hughesy, I Have a... Anyway, his TV show. And you can also listen to his podcast or his radio show, which is Hughesy and Kate. So check those out. He's a brilliant entertainer. He's a great conversationalist. If you're enjoying the podcast, it's back. This is the new season of it, obviously. This is the fourth episode, I believe. They're all out of order, but I think this is the fourth one that we're putting up. So basically, I think at this stage, you will have heard. Who did I turn into then? Heard Luke McGregor. You would have heard. You would have heard Joe Stanley, and you would have heard Rod Quantock and Sam Lane. If you haven't checked those out, please go and check those out. And we have Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all those sort of things, all young, run by, I'm not talking very well, sorry, I've been talking all day and I have to talk again in like an hour. So anyway, you don't need to hear this shit. Most people skip this intro, I imagine. Anyway, Dave Hughes is on the podcast today. I have a new producer called Podcast Mike. Mike, he's doing a fantastic job. If you would like to support this podcast and see it come out more regularly, I pay Mike and I pay our producer, Mike Howell, and I pay James Fosdyke, who does the art. But this podcast does not make any money, obviously. So there's quite a lot of outlay for each episode. If you like it and you would like to help support it, we have a Patreon page, patreon.com/tofop, T-O-F-O-P. And that's where you can find all the podcasts that Charlie and I do and our separate ones. And you can support all that. At some stage, we'll have a philosophy level of that. We'll come up with some reward level and people can sign up to that. But in the meantime, if you want to chuck in a couple of bucks to help pay everybody, that is helpful. Look, the podcast comes out regardless. So if you don't want to, then that's fine. But if you would like to, then that would be helpful. All right. That's way too much. Oh, God. I'm so sick of talking. All right. I'll talk to you soon. See ya. Hello. Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. And this is how the podcast starts, mate. I ask you who you are. So yes. Who are you?
David Hughes.
That's
I've got
it?
My phone's going because I've got two phones at the moment because of the TV show, Hughesy, We Have a Problem. Tonight's episode, I've give out my phone number on live on air.
Hang on. So explain phones and you and what's going on.
All right, so what's going on with phones is me. I'm actually trying to give up my phone, to be honest, because I've...
Your way of doing that is the cigarette smoking approach of like getting as many phones as you possibly can until you're sick of them.
So, yes, but I've actually... Back to me phone before I get to why I've done this on tonight's episode, which was filmed a while back. So if I it was only filmed a few weeks ago, but before I'd given up my phone. So it was filmed a few weeks ago. Now I'm back on my phone because of tonight's episode. But,
okay.
But you know what? Last week...
I mean, that does sound very much like a junkie making excuses for... I've got it because of the TV show.
It's very close to being a junkie, actually, phone addiction. And, you know, for example, last week I went to Hobart, couldn't find my phone, running around the house, got to go to Hobart. I'm going to miss this plane. Where's my phone? Eventually, got to make a decision, got to go to Hobart without my phone because I've got to make the plane. And I slept the best I've slept in years because I didn't have my phone with me and I wasn't lying in bed just scrolling through Instagram, Twitter, emails, Facebook, all that stuff. So, and I decided that I'm going to basically get rid of my phone, you know, from that Hobart trip. And you know what? I haven't completely got rid of it, but I have not looked at it so much. And you know what? When you are not addicted to your phone, it doesn't run out of power. You know what I mean? So imagine for me, it'd be like if you dabbled in heroin but weren't addicted to it, you know, you could really probably make your bag of heroin last a long time.
Right. Essentially, if you've got some spare heroin around the house, you're probably not addicted.
Yes.
Like if you can keep the heroin in the cupboard.
If you can have some
heroin and go, you know what, let's just keep this other heroin for later. Heroin doesn't go off, right?
Absolutely. So, if there's been heroin in your house for longer than probably a month,
you're probably not addicted.
You're probably fine. Not that I've ever had heroin, and I probably shouldn't joke about it like that, but yes, probably some people do that.
Right.
I have no idea.
Well, there's functional. I mean, Paul Kelly's a good example of someone who has spoken about the fact that he had a reasonable heroin habit for a very long time and was very functional with having a reasonable heroin habit. So
never ended up in jail for having stolen.
Never stole anything. Kept writing good songs. Kept going on tour. Didn't fuck up and, you know, pass out on stage during the Don Bradman song.
Well, there you go. So yes, back to where I was at. So yes, so the phone, but you know what? We're missing so much of life. I mean, I'm starting to preach now, Will, and I shouldn't preach on your podcast, but we are missing so much of life by, if you don't have your phone with you and you walk around, you just see everyone staring at their phones. It's crazy. It's madness.
We've become it really quickly, haven't we?
Really quick.
I mean, and it adds to the level of our public association with each other.
Yes.
Like, you know, you see people down the street who will happily stand in front of you because they're checking a message on their phone. So then you're a little bit more pissed off that you almost ran into somebody on the street.
Yes.
Or you did run into them because you were also on your
phone. I know.
Like traffic, that's a big one. Like you see people just walking across like a walkway on their phone and the fucker in the car nearly hits them because they're also on their phone.
Mate, I honestly, I've spent so much time on my phone in the car, which is like, I don't drink at all, but even when I did, I wouldn't drink drive. But you know, over many years now, I'm so often looking at my phone while I'm driving. It's just, I mean, just if you actually ran someone over while you were doing that, you go to jail, and rightly so.
Right.
But you're risking that on a daily basis now. Like almost everyone is. It's absolutely nuts.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I saw in LA and where they have not been as strict about your phone in your car yet and drinking and driving and stuff as much either. Although they're a bit all or nothing over there. It's 0.08 and they don't have RBTs in the way that we do.
They do the test, don't they?
The sobriety test. But if you get busted, you lose your license like for a very long time.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
like a $10,000 fine. So it's one of those things of going, you know, up to a point, we're going to let you get away with it. But if you, step over the line, you are going to get smashed by
this. Yeah, right, yeah.
The phone thing, I was walking down the street and there was this guy on his phone and the cops, you know, pulled him over because he was on his phone and he was so like engaged in what he was doing on his phone. He pulled over to the side of the road, kept on his phone and just tried to wave the cops by as if they were after somebody else. So I was like, no, mate, if you get off your phone for a second, they're going to realize
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's you that are after. You're the criminal.
Oh, yeah. So, look, so, yes, I'm trying to give up my phone. And I am engaging more in life. But having said that, a few weeks ago, I filmed an episode of Hughesy, We Got a Problem, and I put my phone number on the screen. So, and my actual phone number.
Why?
The one that you've got. Because my point was, everyone's got my number. I've had the same number for 20 years. I don't care who's. I literally don't care who has my number. I give it out all the time. And
do you not answer it if it's a number you don't recognize? Is that your?
Oh no, I'll still answer it. Absolutely, but people don't ring that often. They really don't. I mean, they just. So yeah, I rarely get prank calls. I really do. So I put it. So the studio audience had my actual phone number, and they rang me. You know, it'll be on. It's on. You know, on it. Would be on
it
air.
It will have been on air. People can go back to 10 play or
absolutely,
whatever and
yes.
check it
the
out.
The one with Charlie Pickering and Josh Thomas, their first appearances on the show. So, yeah, so I answered it. But then I thought I wanted to keep that for the actual broadcast of the TV so that that number would go out to Australia. But my management, we've got the same management, they didn't want that to happen. So so we've changed.
So hang on, your management, I mean, look at them, the fun police, didn't want you, popular entertainer Dave Hughes, to give out your actual phone number on national television?
Yes, that's
they
right.
They thought that was problematic.
Too much, they
this
thought.
Is the management company who won't give it to a journalist who's interviewing you for an interview. They also had a problem with you giving it out on telly.
Exactly. So, but having said that, they did send me photos the other day. You know, I send you photos and I'll put them out on social media. And one of the photos they sent me, they obviously haven't checked, is me next to the screen on the TV show with my actual phone number on it.
Oh.
So they've sent that to me. So I could just put that on my Instagram and go, guys, well, that's the photo you sent me to publicise the show. So, but I think for tonight,
I'm going to prove a point to you guys by putting my phone number out there.
So I think, though, that tonight, I think they've changed the phone number. They've given me another phone number and our management have given me a new SIM card to answer tonight when it goes to air, so I can answer the phone with this new number in it. But when I set up the SIM card with I used my iCloud. So okay, now sure. All the photo, all the number, all the, because on the radio this morning, I gave that number out and I've got a lot of calls, but all those calls are still going to my actual phone. So I've got about 400 text messages, maybe actually 1,500, which have come through to my actual phone now from just people around Australia from the radio. And that's going to continue tonight. So
that's so that's interesting. Have you had a flick through the messages?
Yeah,
to
most
see
of them
what
are positive.
Say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can have a look at them now if you like. So there's a stack of messages there. There's 1,882 text messages.
Jesus.
All right, so, yeah. You can have a look if you like. Have a look. This is just from... That's from the radio today on the Hit Network. So, yeah, we do a show on 4:30 around the nation, Hughesy and Kate. So their messages... I went on all the radio shows this morning, all the Hit Network shows.
The first one I've clicked is like literally a meme joke about Wayne Carey, the footballer.
Yeah, right.
Did you see this?
No, I haven't seen it, no.
What's the difference between Wayne Carey and Skippy the Bush Kangaroo? Skippy can root his mate's missus and still be a kangaroo. I mean, not the most topical of all material to be sending through. I
would have preferred a Steve Smith, Dave Warner one, but yeah, that's funny. That's funny.
Hey, Hughesy, can you give me some advice for bodybuilding? Also, my wife and I have found out we're having a baby. Can you please send me a video of you congratulating her?
Yeah, has he got a name there? No, there's no name of that person.
No, didn't leave it.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's 1,800 messages like that,
a lot
imagine.
Of attachment images. Free tickets. A lot of free tickets.
A lot of free
requests.
Tickets. Yeah, fair enough. So, anyway, so I don't mind, basically. Yeah.
So the idea of this podcast, Hughesy, is that I ask people if they have a philosophy towards anything.
Yes.
It can be work, love, life, regardless. But you've always struck me as a person who, you know, like looks into different ways of thinking. I mean, even this phone thing is about you going, what is my life like right now?
Yeah.
What are the destructive elements of my life right now? And how can I have a better relationship with those destructive elements in my life? Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I've over the years, as you know, people say I'm addicted to giving things up, and you know, I've given up alcohol, marijuana, tobacco. What else have I given up? I've given up adult content, never porn. Absolutely, completely given up porn, which is that can be addictive as well. So yeah, I'd like to try to, you know, just keep my life, trying to keep my life more simple. So, yeah.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Like, because that insight that people have about you, that you are, like you do get to a point every now and again where you just go, right, I'm giving this up.
Yeah,
my solution is not to, you know, cut this back have a more healthy relationship with this. My solution is that you are dead to me now.
Yeah.
You are dead to me phone. You are dead to me alcohol and bongs. You are dead to me whatever it is, you know, along the way. What is that, do you think? Where does that come from?
Some things I think it's you know, alcohol, for instance, is like, I think if you do have a, and I don't want to turn this into an AA meeting, but if you do have an issue with drinking, you know, I mean, I know people who are, no good on the grog, and they say, I'm not drinking for a month, and I, oh, good luck to, you know, and they get through that month, and then they continue to where, and they were exactly where, how they were before. So I think with alcohol, it's easier not to have the first drink rather than to have to stop after two. I think that's my opinion of that, but not for everyone, obviously, only for the certain selection of the population who I think who are, you know, I think it's a genetic, you know, I think it's a genetic thing, and maybe I'm wrong, but yeah, so for me, that was easier not to have any drinks. So yeah, over the years. But I'm only having chips once a week now. So I was having hot chips every single day and have for a long time, but I'm only having them on Fridays and only generally one serve.
And do you think, because you're very healthy at the moment, you're looking fantastic.
Yeah, I've got leaner because of that. Yeah.
And you think it's the chips?
The chips and the chocolate. Yeah. I've actually given up chips and chocolate. You drop just those two things out of your diet.
You do love to give something up.
No, well, you know, we're recording this just before Easter, and I'm thinking about Easter now. I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Because I'm walking around, you know, the radio studio, the radio station. There's just Easter eggs everywhere. My children love chocolate. There's going to be a lot of Easter eggs in our house over Easter, and I'm wondering how I'm going to go with that. So, do I just let myself go to Easter Sunday and smash it on Easter Sunday? So, yeah, I mean, I love chocolate. I would eat a lot of chocolate every day.
And how much do you reckon?
Oh, well, Easter would start for me probably when, you know, pretty much when they just start putting them in the supermarkets.
In the shops.
Yeah, so like, what, February? Maybe
after Australia
Day. Yeah, absolutely. So
January 27 every year.
I don't think there's anything tastier than an Easter egg for chocolate.
Yeah, I love. I
yeah, and a hollow one. I love that punch when you punch into it and you can snap off a little bit of egg, you know. But I could never. I'd always end up eating pretty much the whole egg. But I love Easter egg chocolate.
Hunter in you, Dave.
I haven't had one Easter egg, and we're almost at Easter Thursday. And here's an example of strength of mind. I did a gig for Lindt Chocolate recently, me and Jimmy Barnes. Jimmy Barnes is a legend.
Isn't he?
Jimmy Barnes had his band, his wife was there, and, you know, it's for Lindt Chocolate Sellers. It was a group of basically women, you know, in their 30s and 40s and 50s. It was probably 100 of them, maybe 200. And I did about 20 minutes or 15 or 20 minutes, and they were a great crowd for me. But Jimmy Barnes smashed it. It was like on a Tuesday night in Manly at some pub in Manly or some back room of some function centre. He could have been, you know, in front of, you know, Eddie Had Stadium or something. He just hit it as hard as Jimmy Barnes can hit it for these Lindt chocolate workers. And it was just, for me, it was just like, yes, just treat every gig and every performance like these are the most important one you've got. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he is also a good example, Jimmy. Like, and we both were very lucky when we were doing the Glass House that we got to kind of know Jimmy Barnes in a way that, you know, well, I certainly hadn't previously known him in that way as kind of a great guest on our show, but also a great friend to our show. Like, there were a couple of times where we had guests pull out at the last moment and our fill-in was Jimmy Barnes, who was just happy to take the call on the day and go, yeah, I'll come in. No
he's
worries.
A real giver, Jimmy. Absolutely. And he's, yeah, he makes the most of his life, you know. So,
He's a good example, this is what I was going to say, of a man who, you know, we live in very different times and I think for a whole bunch of very good reasons about our appreciation of how, you know, women have been treated, you know, across a broad section of society, including our own industry, you know.
Yeah.
And things that were expected and understood as just being the way things were are now being looked back on and going, well, through what we know today, you know, those same behaviours wouldn't be acceptable today. Yeah. He's such a good example of a guy who, you know, if you've read his books or if you've had a look at it, listen to him talk about his past and the sort of, you know, you imagine they were the biggest rock band in Australia and they back were a wild
rock band. 70s, 80s,
And the way that he's sort of, you know, looked back on, you know, aspects of his life and used them to become a better and more interesting person, I think is one of those things that is probably an underrated aspect of who he is as a person.
Like, absolutely. You
know, he could have been one of those guys who's going, nah, I apologize for nothing and that's the way things were. And but he isn't like that. He's like, well, that's the way things were, but I see through my modern eyes that, you know, that that wouldn't be the way things I would do things now.
Yeah, and also, you know, having the ability to learn and never stop learning. So I never stop, And it's I can't remember, someone said that. Some very, very successful person said about their secret of their success is they never stopped learning. They never, you know, every day they took as an opportunity to learn. So yeah, I think someone, it might have been, I think Warren Buffett, you know, the investment guru. Yeah,
I know who
and
Warren Buffett
I think
is.
It might have been Charlie Munger, who's his right-hand man, who's also richer than God. So yeah, and he said it. And these guys are in, I think this Charlie Munger's in his, you know, he's heading towards 90. And still every day is a chance to learn, you know, with the, you know, he's probably got who knows how many billion dollars in the bank or whatever, but it's still every day is a chance to learn. So
it's interesting. I think our job is like a job that you choose, or maybe you don't know it at the time. But one of the aspects about the job that remains interesting about it is that you learn something new about it every time you do a gig or a show.
Absolutely.
Like you can't do it, you can do it for as long as we've done it, like, you know, 20 plus years. And you still know that coming into the Melbourne Comedy Festival, that every single night we will probably learn something about our job that we didn't know the night before.
Yeah, you can always improve. And, you know, and the best compliment, I think, is when someone says, I've seen you many times and that's the best I've ever seen you. And so, you know, which is great. And whether they're just saying it to suck up to you or not, it's a beautiful
thing. Regardless of that, it's great.
Yes,
if you're messaging Husey on his number.
Yeah. I've seen you a lot and that's the best I've ever seen you. Or another one is I never laugh at comedians and I laugh at you. You know, which is it's more a selfish thing for me to hear. But I've seen you a lot. Always
could
liked
you please
you.
List which comedians you haven't laughed at for my enjoyment.
So always. I mean, hopefully that means you continue to learn. You know,
I don't know if we've spoken about this. You know, in the various times we've talked over the years, but I had one guy come up to me once and he said, you know, I love you. I think you're a great comedian. You're my second favorite comedian in the world. And it's one of those ones where you're like, I could just walk away with that.
Yeah,
second in the
world.
Yeah,
you had to ask.
But you have to ask. Yeah. And he's like, Rodney Rood, then you. And I was like, well, that is a broad range of comedic stylists.
You know what? I do love Rodney Rood, though, I must say.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I love Rodney Rood's the first comedian I ever saw live. And you know what funny is, I was remember it was at a pub in my hometown of Warrnambool in southwest Victoria, and it was called the Lady Bay Hotel, where as an 18-year-old or 17-year-old, I used to go there and get smashed every weekend, you know, and often get beaten up just because I wasn't violent, but I was, you know, a smart ass who couldn't fight. So, so I'd get punched reasonably often. But I saw Rodney Rood there, and I was in Brighton the back, and he was no way he probably would have seen me, but I was so desperate to go to the toilet, but my fear was if I stand up here, Rodney Rood is going to see me from the stage and he's going to mock me, and it'll be the most mortifying moment of my life. So I just can't stand up. I can't possibly go to the toilet. I almost died that night with bladder problems, you know. But, you know, to think that now I'm on the one on stage and other people are having that sort of issues in my audience.
And did it teach you anything? If somebody gets up to go to the toilet, do you let them go to the toilet in peace, or do you comment
on
that
and crucify them? You think about it, don't you? Like, if you're halfway through a story, you're like, you could have waited a little punchline, but yeah, it's funny. Oh, what's most annoying, or not most, but an annoying thing is when someone goes to the toilet and you don't comment. And then everyone thinks, oh, it's okay to go to the toilet.
Nah, it's like a school teacher on the first day. You've got to kill one to educate the rest.
You know what? I've never actually, there we go. We're both 20 years into our, or more into our, you know, into our careers. And I've never thought about that. I've never thought about the fact that I've got to nail that first person who goes to the toilet.
Always. You've got to kill the first one who gets up, or everybody thinks they can get up.
That's I've just changed my.
You've got to scare them
into
their
seats. I've just changed my act now. You know? Yeah, so I'm going to, next, I'm not on tonight, but when the comedy festival starts for me Thursday night, first person to go to the toilet, I'm going to slaughter.
I had in my show, I have a false ending. It's not really a false ending, but at about 55 minutes, the sort of first part of the story finishes.
Yeah.
And I guess you could feel like that was the end of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in Adelaide one night, as I'm doing my thank yous, some people got up to...
Sorry, I've got to turn this phone off. This is all the randoms, but I won't answer it.
I like that we started with the idea that you're trying to give up your phone and you've taken like five different calls in the first 15 minutes.
I don't have to turn the phone off. I can turn that off. Slide to answer, slide to take off. So yeah, so hang on. So the false ending in Adelaide.
So the false ending. So some people start getting up to leave because, you know, not in a bad way, just in a...
Yeah, I mean, comedians don't... I don't do encores, I imagine. No. You don't do encores. It's like, so and they would know that.
That's the end. That's it's the end of the one story I'm telling being arrested. Yeah, and they're like, oh, great, that's the end. And I'm like, oh, no, there's still 10 minutes. Like, there's a whole other bit. And I've set up a lot of stuff in the first 55 minutes.
Which is going to get paid off in that really last 10 minutes.
Just stick around.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But you're such a good storyteller. I thought it was over, so yeah. Yeah, no, that's funny. Yeah.
All right. Do you have a philosophy? Is there a certain philosophy that you subscribe to?
You know, we had an ethics person come into the radio station a couple of weeks ago because, I don't know, I think I'm on the Hit Network now and they've had issues in the past. And anyway, they've got an ethics thing. So an ethics guy comes in and he, I've never really been asked about this before. He said, well, why do you do it? And, you know, I don't know if he said, do you think you have a higher calling or whatever? But made me think about it, and I actually do, I reckon, which is to make people, my purpose is to make people laugh at their own lives. Mm. To be able to, you know, as much as I can, as honestly as I can, make fun of my own life, and hopefully that helps people laugh at their situations, to make them realise that everyone's human and we're all pretty much the same in our bullshit. And, you know, if Husey can laugh at his... not that I have many problems, but laugh at whatever, you know, is affecting his ego or, you know, whatever, that, you know, I can as well. So, yeah. So it's, and that's from right from the start when I first started stand-up comedy, when I was on the dole, you know, and didn't have a girlfriend and, you know, I was getting sacked from, you know, dodgy jobs, which, you know, if you get sacked as a dishwasher and you've tried really hard to wash those dishes well, you're in a pretty low position in your life, you know, and to be able to laugh at that, you know, for an example. So, yeah. So,
does it ever... I think, and this is probably, I think the audiences probably get it, even if they don't intellectually get it. Sometimes I think that perhaps critics can, you know, go, oh, he's talking about his kids or he's talking about, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Again,
you know,
he's just talking about,
this. Whereas, like, social satire to me is as equal and as important to, like, you know, political satire, let's call it, or news satire. Because, like, if you are a parent, you know, raising kids, you know, which is the toughest thing in the entire fucking world to do. If somebody's giving you some relief for that or some perspective on that or going, hey, this is, you know how the other night you cried in the middle of the night because you were just like, I can't do this and I fuck it up all the time and I make these mistakes. Yeah. And then there's somebody out there who's going, no, look at all these mistakes that I've made or look at all these things that are going wrong. That plays a great, important role that is beyond, you know, this idea of he's talking about his kids.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Do you think that there is a critical kind of gap there between what people judge you're doing and what you're actually doing?
Only for some. I think there can be, obviously everyone's got their own opinion, but I think some, you know, comedy critics can not get that. And, you know, I mean, that says more about them than it does, you know, me. I mean, I know exactly what I'm doing, which is, you know, and when the great compliment is someone saying, that's my life, you're talking about my life, you know, and that's, but as I said, that's because that is all our lives. Well, you know, that's the human experience.
Reminds me of the time I bought a house on the block.
Exactly. But, you know, that's another thing, which is, I know that's funny as well. But I do talk about that, and I'm not afraid to talk about, you know, people say, oh, you've got to be relatable. But no, I think you've got to be honest. What I want to see from comedians or anyone is honesty. So, yeah. So, and when I first started, I was on the dole and I used to talk about being on the dole and I'd have people come up to me and say, mate, I'm on the dole as well. That made me laugh. You know, and that was, for me, that was nice that, you know, as I said, people are laughing at their, you can laugh at your situation. Why can't they laugh at theirs? And that is, and I still do that. But, you know, having bought a house on the block is probably a bit different. But, yeah.
Well, I would say, though, like, I mean, and again, I'm not saying anything to you that I haven't sort of said to other people.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I want to say it to the audience who are listening to the show. I think that the greatest thing perhaps that you have done comedically, you know, from just from me being a comedian and seeing how you've done it, and you is that transition from being a guy who was famous for being on the Dole, like that was your first stuff that really connected with people, to transitioning to, I still hide from people a certain aspect of the success of my life because...
And people don't think about it. People don't necessarily look, you know, the fact that, you know, you're at a Will Anderson show and, you know, there's 1,500 people around you and he's on for a month in the same theatre. My God, he must be doing well. They don't think about that.
No.
But nor should they. And you're not there to flash your, you know, to brag at your success. Yeah,
fair enough. You've made done something that I can't do, which is found a way to be able to talk about those things. And I've always felt that the audience, there are rare people and they come along every now and again, but it's like the Paul Hogan thing with the tax department.
Yeah, right.
Like
if
Paul Hogan was like Google or like, you know, whatever.
People would be really anti.
We're not gonna let Steve Smith play cricket for a year because like he let a guy, you know, sandpaper a ball for a second.
God,
but like,
funny.
You know, Paul Hogan, you know, can not pay his taxes and we're all like,
he's a character, isn't he?
Right.
Yeah, that only wasted anyway. So, yeah, that's
it's a victory for everyone,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And I do think that there is an aspect of your success that I think people believe is...
aspirational.
When you buy a house on the block, they feel like, good on you, Z.
Yeah, but, you know. I often do follow that when I talk about it. I was on the Dole for 7 years, so, you know, I know struggle, so, and I was, and it was embarrassing, but, you know, I made fun of that. Yeah. And now I make fun of buying a house on the block. So, so whatever you are in life, life will. And that's what, you know, one of my philosophies is: people go, "You're going to run it." Well, you run out of material. And what I say is, life will always be funny, no matter where I am in life. It will be funny, and there'll be humor around me. And you know, no matter what, you know. So whether I'm in prison or you know. Hopefully I never go to prison, but touch wood. But yes,
mate, I never thought I was going to get arrested. But exactly. How things change so quickly. Well,
exactly. That's the same thing. At the time, I'm sure it was stressful when you were in, was it Albury? Was it, where were you? No, it was Wagga.
Wagga.
Wagga. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that was funny actually when I saw that message. No, I think I saw you, did I see it trending on, I can't remember how I saw it, but it was a lot of talk.
Number one trending topic on Twitter. And as my friends have said to me since, because I didn't see any of this, of course, because I was at the police station. And they had my phone. And so all this sort of stuff, the news and the Twitter and all this stuff happened without me. And I haven't gone back.
Yeah.
Like I just was like, that's for other people. Yeah. I have my version of what happened and whatever. And so number one Twitter topic. And as Justin said to me, he goes, look, to be honest, if you're number one and it's not because you're dead, that's a good day.
Absolutely. My name has never, you know, you'd like to think, as you have, you've done a lot of brilliant performances.
Hopefully.
You know, over many years, we used to do The Glass House. The Gruen is one of the biggest successes of Australian television's ever had, The Gruen. There's no doubt about that. But, and it continues to be. But, you know, you never trend for that, do you?
No.
The only time I've ever, I swear to God, you know, and I've opened the Logies, done well, you know, like, you know, whatever. Only time I've ever trended as on Twitter, my actual name, is when I did a stand-up spot on the footy show, the AFL footy show, and it didn't go well. And it was like my Craig McLaughlin on, you know, bloody NRL footy show moment. And it was like, for whatever reason, I'd done the gala the night before, the Comedy Festival gala, smashed it at the Palais, 3,000 people eating out of the palm of my hand. So the next night I'm on the footy show doing a stand-up spot and I thought, you know, I'm the king of the world. And it just did not go well. And when you're dying on the footy show, you're like, oh, that's a tough one. And then like trending on Twitter and like, oh God, people are mean. People related to football are mean. They're so mean.
Anyway. So mean. I made the mistake over the weekend of suggesting, and I wasn't actually even having a go. This is like how mean football people can be, just as an example. I said of the Steve Smith thing, I said it feels like a bit of a James Heard moment.
Oh,
I said if he falls on his sword now and he takes full responsibility, he'll be back playing in a year. He'll be welcome back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you try to deny it and drag it out, then you do more.
Yeah.
Still, so it turns out there's still some people who are pretty sore about that Essendon thing.
Oh, yeah.
And they come at you. Like, I didn't even look. But you know when you don't look,
mate,
and you're still aware of it? You know,
but also,
that
a lot
of
those people might have been defending James Heard. Seriously, yeah. On that ill-fated stand-up spot on the footy show, I did a James Heard joke.
Yeah.
And the ones that come hardest are the team, the supporters of that team. So whether it's him or anyone else, he's Essendon, their supporters, they were the ones who would have come hardest at me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, you, fuck you. You know, and it's like, yeah, so you're unfunny or whatever. So, yes, very delicate to talk to jokes about football teams.
Yes.
Whether they're NRL or AFL or whoever they are.
Yeah, a lot of guys with cars in their avatar suddenly have some firm opinions about your work.
At one point I thought I'm going to hit back at guys who nail me for the footy. I've never had any, it's the most like negativity I've ever had is being on the footy show. It's like, yeah, one guy, I just go, I'm going to go back at people, you know, and I went back at someone who had a go at me, and then I clicked on their actual photo and they had a machine gun. So they're holding a machine gun. So, and then I think I said, that's not a real machine gun. And the guy goes, yes, it is.
It's like, well, fair enough then, mate. Couldn't agree with you more. I really was terrible.
You're welcome to your opinion.
How do you go with feedback on things as a general rule? What is the... Because we live in a world now where you could be getting feedback on what you do every single moment. Like, you know, you can send a tweet, then you can sit there and see what people's responses
Absolutely.
Are to the tweet. And Instagram, you're on the radio every day. There are people who can call. You've given out your phone number on national TV.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
people who can message you. What is your relationship with feedback and how you then, you know, use it, how it informs you as a human being?
Look, it's a lot better than it used to be. And that's through the, I think, the weight of numbers of, you know, the internet has opened it up to everyone having an opinion. So you become thicker skinned, no doubt about it. Back in the days when the Glass House started, you know, on the ABC back in 2001, 2002, and the only feedback then really was, you know, you open up The Age or the Herald Sun TV Guide or, you know, Sydney Morning Herald or whatever, and there's like a letter from, you know, Barry from Echuca who, you know, says Dave Hughes is not funny. And you're like, that's painful.
Right.
Painful. You know, it's like, you know, you're angry at him. You're angry at the editor of the newspaper for deciding to put that one in there. You're angry, you know. I remember once doing radio and then halfway through the show, you know, doing a breakfast show on Nova back in the day, halfway through the show, I said, I didn't even think about whatever. And someone come in to do a comedy spot on our show, and they weren't trying to be mean, but they said, oh, gee, that was not very nice what they said in the paper about you. I'm like, what did they say? And then he looked at like, oh God, I shouldn't have said that. And I said, what have they said? And then I realized that my team at Nova had, Hughie and Kate, probably Dave O'Neill was with us back then as well, they had taken the TV guide out of the newspapers. And so they'd obviously read it earlier before I got there and then taken it out. And I hadn't realized, oh, this is Wednesday or Thursday and there's no I hadn't realized there was no TV guide. So I'm like, where is it? Don't hide it from me.
But that's what they used to do. That was show business. You know, you wouldn't get shown the bad letters.
I know.
You know, they cut the stuff out of the
paper. Exactly. So I'm like, where is it? I need to see it now. And it was mean. I can't remember what it was, but it was mean. And it did affected the rest of the show. Like, ridiculous.
I think that, I mean, it's interesting with comedy more than anything is that, firstly, you know, there's probably rare areas of society where performance is so subjective.
Yes.
Right? Like, even the biggest comedians in the world, whoever they might be,
yeah.
You'll find more people who find them unfunny.
Yeah.
And when somebody thinks something isn't funny, it's almost like an insult that other people do find
it funny.
I know,
you get angry. I mean, I remember watching, I was online for whatever reason, a tweet from some stranger saying, Jerry Seinfeld has never been funny, will never be funny. And I thought, well, that's it. I'm just relaxing from now on. If that guy who has, you know, is world famous and has, you know, more money than...
Most famous, rich and successful comedian.
Yeah.
But also made a TV show that you can still sit down...
Like, and laugh.
And laugh at now.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's never been funny.
Someone has taken time out of their day to write that on the internet. I just need to relax about negativity that comes my way. So, yeah.
In general, then, how do you receive feedback? So, like, you know, if, for example, you say, you know, I'm not going to take the feedback of, you know, random strangers on the internet.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're a human being and you want to be better at what you do.
Yeah.
Is it just internal? Do you, like, have your own standards that you set and sort of aspire to? Or are there, like, external sort of ways that you, you know, improve what it is that you do and get feedback?
Well, I definitely want to be the funniest I can be, no doubt. But it's tricky taking it from other comedians because you take it on board, you know, and it can make you paranoid. But if someone, if another comedian says, I really like that bit, whatever it is, that it will become my favourite bit.
Right.
You know, and then I will hit that bit next time I do stand-up with so much confidence, it will become even funnier because someone said, you know, I remember Lee Mack, the English comedian, many years ago, we were doing the same, he's a very funny guy, but we're doing the same, he does Would I Lie to You in England, anyway, yep. Lee Mack, we were doing a the same venue at the Melbourne Town Hall, and he said one bit, he said, I can't remember what it is now, but he said, I really like that bit, and it became my favourite bit. And I just hit it with so much confidence after he said that. So, yeah. But if someone, people are, Nick, someone the other day said, sent me a message saying, yeah, I really like you. I was doing a gig in Hobart at the Spiegel Tent. Show was really funny. They said, but why do you swear so much? And I've got angry at that comment before, but I actually thought, you know what? Why? I probably did. When I'm tired, I swear too much. You know what it's like? You just swear, and every second word is, when you put fuck together twice, fuck. Yeah, why am I saying that? And so, yeah, saying fuck on stage should really be, and I'm all for saying it, but it should be an integral part of a story, really, I think.
I agree with you.
And I say it too much. Having people saying, well, that's ridiculous you saying that, but I agree that often I do say it too much.
No, I agree that I say it too much now as well. That's a good example of one of those things that I'm exactly the same as you. Yeah. Like, I've had feedback over the years from people going, you swear too much. And my immediate reaction was like, fuck you. Yeah. I'll do what I like. You know
yes,
what I
mean? Yes,
like,
absolutely.
You know, that's the way I express my art. But
yeah.
Certainly as I've got older, I think it probably is less dignified to be swearing as much as I was swearing when I was young. But B, it really is that sort of thing of going, no, a lot of the time it was, you know, me being underprepared or nervous or tired.
Tired. I think it's a tiredness thing. Or if you're a bit stressed, you'll swear more than you should. And I do sometimes go, hang on, just calm down with the fucks, all right? You're about to say fuck, is it necessary? You know, put it where it is necessary, it's going to have more impact. So, yeah.
Right.
So that's one bit of feedback I'll definitely take on board now than I used to.
I had Tom Ballard has a new show on the ABC called Tonightly.
Yeah.
And they've been getting in a little bit of trouble about the language that they've been using on
that
show.
Yeah, I saw one story about calling a politician a...
Yeah, the C word.
Yeah.
I mean, we can say it, but we don't need to. Everyone knows what we're talking about, right? It was interesting because a journalist rang me and, you know, I thought my responsibility at that point was to...
defend him.
Yeah, fly the flag.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yep,
to fly the flag enough. For him. Yep, and as I said, you know, to the journalist, I said, I think that most of the people who are criticising it have a problem with the AB in front of the C rather than the UNT after the C.
I like it,
And so, but the truth of it is that we had spoken after he'd been doing 2 weeks of the show and he said, do you have any feedback? And I said, you should swear less. Because I'd been watching it and I thought he was swearing too much.
Yeah,
now, they didn't stop it,
yeah.
but... Well, but I can understand from an audience's point of view.
Yeah, I was
getting in the way.
Doing a TV show, which I've been doing. Usually we have a problem, 8:30 Tuesday nights, repeats Fridays at some time.
Play. Watch it online at Tenplay, right?
Tenplay, absolutely, Tenplay.
Probably watch the whole series if you haven't seen any of it yet.
Absolutely, you could, absolutely. You know, as the host of the show, I'm not swearing at all, really. I think I swore once on the taping the other day, but generally I'm not swearing at all. And... but if every now and again a guest comes on and starts swearing and just doesn't stop, you know, like even my co-host, Kate Langbrook, the other day, she was on, who I love having her on the show, but I said to say, Kate, can you just, and I said it on, whether it makes the cut or not, probably won't, but I said, could you just, less swearing, you know, like she was just starting to really wind up with the fucks. I'm like, you know, and again.
Well, the other thing is on a panel show is like, and look, again, this is like the difference between hosting something and being a guest on something. What you don't realize, when you're a host, what you realize is if one person goes for it, then all the others are like, it's like at the gala.
I know.
It's like when they tell you you can't swear at the gala. And then if someone goes out early and says, fuck, everyone out backstage is like, oh, can we say fuck?
Yeah, I know.
I got told
absolutely.
We can say fuck. I'm saying fuck.
Yeah. I've been galas where I've said, Yeah, exact same experience. Or he said fuck. Well, probably even you. Will said fuck. I'm going to say fuck. And then afterwards, I didn't really need to say fuck, but I did it anyway.
I don't think Will did either. I think we both said a lot of unnecessary fucks.
So I was, I did say to her, like, yeah, just calm down with the fucks, you know. So, and again, I think it's sometimes you get stressed so you start swearing more than you normally would. So,
What's your relation? I mean, we can talk about a million things, I'd love to talk to you about comedy, really, because I'm going to put this up. This will be probably just the second episode of this new season hear. So the Sam Lane, when we're recording this, the Sam Lane episode will go out tomorrow. And then I'll put this one out so that it's, up for the comedy festival.
Yeah, great.
And so I want to start by kind of just talking to you about what's your relationship with stand-up like at the moment? Like, do you look forward to the festival?
I look forward to stand-up, whether it's the festival. I look forward to turning up to a venue and walking on stage for free, which I do much more now than I used to do. Much more, actually. I'm much more prepared now to put myself in. I had a time where I'm like, oh no, I'm not. You don't want to see me, you buy a ticket to my theatre show, all that sort of stuff. Or this venue doesn't look very good. I'll get up there and I won't look great. And then people will think I'm not great because I did a venue that wasn't right, So that sort of thing, So I was less, I'd go to America and I'd be at a comedy club in America and I'm like, oh, I'm not getting up there. What if no one laughs? And then I'll feel bad about myself for the rest of my life, But now, if I'm in, not that I'm in America very often, but I am in America, I'm like, where can I get up? Not that I go there very often, but I want to go more. But I know that you spend a lot of time in America, but I'm more of an attitude of get on that stage and experience it, whatever it is. And you got nothing to lose. And that was the thought I had when I had my first good gig, is walking on stage, you're already a winner for walking on this stage, So, and I'm more back to that attitude. I love stand-up comedy.
I find it interesting from the outside. Often people will ask you, it's almost more amazing to them that you would go from, a thousandth seats at the Athenaeum to doing a gig in front of 50 people in, the back of some pub or, above some laundrette or whatever it is, right? But I've done a few this week because I'm running, just trying to fine-tune some stuff for my show, and I've dropped into just local, little shows.
Yeah.
And they've all been fun in their own different ways. Oh, and I've definitely certainly learned something from each of them that I wouldn't have learned from.
Mate, if I didn't have a family, I would be on stage every night. But you've got to maintain a relationship as well. So if I'm, in Brisbane for 5 nights and I get home for the 6th night and, I've got to choose between hanging out with my beautiful wife or going to a stand-up room. I mean, if there was one around the corner, I could just sit in there for just like 20 minutes. And there is one. There's a cafe around. It's in St. Kilda in Melbourne, in Blessington Street. There's a little cafe. Literally half the gig is outside. So, because it's so small, it's like literally 2 meters wide, this cafe. And so but it's literally around the corner from my house and it's on a Tuesday night.
You know what they need? Mm. They need one at the airport.
Yes.
So imagine if they had a room at the airport.
Great idea.
You're like, I've got a 2-hour layover before blah, blah, blah. Send the message around, if you're at the airport and you want something to do. Pop-up comedy club's happening now. Dave Hughes is down there. He's got half an hour before his flight. He's going to do a set.
That's a great, I'm not joking. That's a great idea. That should happen. Well, we should investigate.
Okay,
that.
We'll cut this out of the podcast and that'll be our $1 billion idea. I mean, there's comedians going through airports all the time, right? Often you'd have more than one there at the same time.
You just have to...
Just organise it so audience, that... Right?
It's a captive audience and everyone's listening out for their plane being called. I mean, so halfway during your setup, during your punchline, you'll probably have to hear...
Well, you'd have to have the... I think you have a soundproof room of some kind, but you have the board behind you so that people can see their flights being called.
Yeah, I'm trying to think how we can keep people from not missing their flights.
Exactly. Board behind you.
Board behind you. You're not going to miss your flight. It will be up there. Yeah. But also, out of the soundproof room, apart from calling people to their flights, right through the airport, Dave Hughes is performing in 5 minutes at this spot. And so people are listening out for their flights being called, so they're attuned. It's perfect advertising.
Yeah.
Board up behind them. And say that your board, your flight will be on the board behind them. You won't miss your flight. That's a great idea, man.
I mean, I have a show that's really perfect for this. all right, I'm just going to have a pause for a bathroom break, which I always have to do when we record at this time of the day because I've had 19 coffees.
Yeah, no, I get it. What is it, global warming? We're going to blame global warming, are we? People, I don't give a shit about global warming. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I just don't care. People say, what about your kids? I say, you know how much money I've spent on swimming lessons?
those bastards will be grateful one day. I don't mind surfers getting bitten by sharks either, because I grew up on the beach down in bloody southwest Victoria, the shipwreck coast. You gnarly surf down there. And the surfers, they got respected by the chicks, yeah? All the chicks wanted to go with surfers. I was a snorkeler. Snorkelers end up with very little attention off the ladies. I believe it's because the surfers do all their work on the surface where they're showing off, where the snorkelers do all their work underneath, yeah? Do a lot of good work down there. It goes unnoticed. But ladies, have a think about it. Yeah. Who do you want to go out with? A surfer who quits early and he's pulling bongs in his combi van, or a snorkeler who stays down there till the job's done? Think about it. Thank you, girls. Thank you. Respect the snorkeler. We don't come up till we get a tap on the forehead. Job done? All right. Let's have a cup of tea.
So we're talking Comedy Festival. We were just, I mean, just talking about it then as we had a little break. But so we both think we did our first four runs in 97.
Yes.
And I've done it every single year and you've had 1 year off.
I think so. And one, maybe two, but definitely one.
But yeah, but not a lot. But no. You've had a break at some stage. Yes. You've not done the festival.
Yeah.
Now, and this is what we were talking about. Because to me, I feel like now that it's like that thing where I'm going, well, I guess I just keep doing it every year until I die.
Yeah.
Because I've done it. Like, because once I break this streak, I'm never going back to getting a streak this long together ever again.
Your streak is probably the longest, I reckon. I don't want to tell you that, but I reckon it's probably the longest.
See, well, that doesn't help, does it? Because then you're like, well, then why would I break the streak? But how did you find... So firstly, let's just start with how did you find the years that you weren't doing the festival?
Oh, I missed it. I must say I missed it. More than anything, you miss the attention. You miss being part of it, I think. I'd almost want to not be in Melbourne when it happened, I reckon. I know Dave O'Neill, who's a friend of ours, he's helped me out with the TV show, actually. He's been great. But he
also has an excellent podcast called The Debrief, which is really, really good.
It is, yeah.
Your episode with Mooney recently. Was it with who else? Brad Oakes was in the car. That's right. There was a Lima and Mooney one.
Yes,
yeah. But similar sort of vibe.
Yes.
And really just a really good podcast he's doing, Dave.
Yeah, it's after gigs, so you're literally driving home from some, you know, two horse town, generally. But he's gone overseas because the festival's on. He's taking his family for a holiday. But yeah, I think part of it for him is that he's not doing the festival and he's overseas. So yeah, I mean, I think
a footballer going away in AFL grand final week.
Yeah,
if you're not playing in the game, it's kind of just rubbing it in your face.
But I don't really. For me, mate, it's just the fact I just love stand up comedy and it's an opportunity to do it in my hometown. Do you know what I mean? For a month. So, and it's with a family. You know, it's hard. Traveling is tough on them more than me, to be honest. But although the kids couldn't care less, to be honest. But so it's an opportunity to do it for that long. But I mean, for you, you could easily miss a year, and you know, and you could. But if I was you, I'd want to, in that time, do gigs. You know, do a country tour or something. You know, but miss the actual Melbourne festival, but do a country tour. Or, you know, I just love being on stage.
There's two things that I'm really fascinated by, because I was just saying to you that because when I got arrested happened like 8-9 months ago.
Yeah.
That's the longest lead time I've had
to write a joke or write a routine.
Think about an idea. I feel like it's been
worth it.
Yeah, it's been like I think this show is going to be the best thing I've done because. A, because I have a funny story to tell, but mostly because that funny story to tell happened to me in June, not in December, right?
Yeah.
I've had the time to work it and come up with better jokes and go, why is this here? Does this actually, should this be here? You know, those sort of things.
Mm.
And I do wonder if I took a year off next year worked on my show for the next year. Do you think it would be better?
I think it would be, but that's having never done it myself. So, you know, I'm saying, but as long as we know, you've got to be on stage to make the jokes work. The jokes aren't going to work just with you in your lounge room, you know. So you've got to, or maybe they do for you, but for me, it's like you've got to be somewhere on stage working them out. So if you could do, if there was a tour that I could work out where I only hit venues every 2 years, but I could work all the time in that meantime between the, you know, for those 2 years, I think that's the ideal, actually, isn't it? And you probably can. But I think
you're right about the idea of on stage, though. That was probably the bit I forgot the most about this show, because I was like, this is like, I know what this show is going to be. I've worked it out.
Yeah.
Here are the beats and the jokes and whatever. I always say to people, come on the first night. I have a very loyal Adelaide crowd who always come on the first night. It's like one of that show will sell out like immediately because people know it's the first time that I've really mostly ever done the show.
Yeah.
And this year in Adelaide, I landed with, I thought, like the most fully, you know, formed version of what the show would be.
Yeah, yeah.
It would be unrecognisable to the show I'm doing now four weeks later.
Of course. And that's the thing. That's why you've got to keep working. You can't, I'll have 2 years off or whatever and then I'll come back. You can't just come back to stage 2 years later. You've got to be working every bloody pub and club in those times. And then if you don't hit Melbourne for 2 years, but will you have worked that whole 2 years, boom, you know? And then people have had that year of missing you. We might have to have next year off.
But this is the other thing. So these are the thoughts that go through our heads. You go, I'll come up back with a better show. People have had a year of missing me, so I bet my crowds will go up. You know, I haven't been around for a year.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's that other bit that you go,
they've forgotten about
you. I forgot how to do it, and they'll forget who I am.
Yeah, I had that year off and gave this other guy or girl the space to become the next star, and they have, and then I'm just done.
Oh, sorry, mate. You can't actually have the comedy theatre.
You're not getting on the
Celia
gala.
Celia Piccola's got it. Yeah,
I won't have you on the gala, no. You're still doing comedy? Oh, I didn't think you were. I thought you'd retired. Yeah.
Well, okay. So getting older as a comedian is an interesting thing as well, because when we started, and I talk about this a fair bit with people, which is that we had the luxury of, we've grown up as our industry has grown up.
Yeah.
There were plenty of great pioneers who went before us, and certainly people who built, you know, amazing careers and stuff before us. But this idea that you might now just go into stand-up comedy as a profession, that might lead to television and writing and radio and all the opportunities that might come with that, and that there's a scene that supports the idea that you could just be a live comedian, was not something that, it was something that has grown and emerged as we've been doing this.
Yeah.
So the idea that there would be a bunch of us in our mid-40s, you know, who've been doing it for 20 years, still doing the festival, that's not my memory of what the festival was like when we started as kids.
Yeah, it was a lot smaller, basically. And the festival circuit around Australia has grown beautifully, really.
A compliment to Australia. The difference is, like, remember when the only big selling acts would be international acts?
Absolutely.
Whereas now at the festival, it's the other way around. Yeah, the majority of the tickets will be sold by local acts.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot more tickets being sold. Yeah, the amount of tickets they sell in Melbourne, I don't know where it was in the paper the other day, they sold 750,000 tickets last year in Melbourne for the festival over a month. That's incredible. 750,000 tickets. Wow, I wish I got a better percentage than that, to be honest. But going okay.
Did you do your maths?
No, I did not maths. No, I didn't do that. I didn't do the maths. I didn't. I thought about doing the maths and thought, no, I'm not doing the maths.
Well, then you've got to take the money into it as well. You've got to go, like, your tickets are, some of those are $5 or $10
tickets. Let's not even worry about it. It's not.
You really want a percentage of budget. Mate, that's what you really want.
I think one of the greatest quotes ever is, comparing yourself to others will only make you vain or bitter. That is just the greatest quote. Vain or bitter when you compare yourself to others. And both of those you don't want to be.
Isn't it interesting, though? Like, it's that thing of extremes, isn't it? That, like, you know, that, yeah, it's like feedback, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The ones who think you're totally shit probably aren't right. And the ones who think you can't do anything wrong, they're not right either. And it's a bit the same with that idea of, like,
Who's bigger and better and happier and more successful
and whatever than I am.
Mate, it's an endless, you know.
Well, how do you overcome that, though? Because that's a very intrinsic part of, I think, early on in our careers, part of the grit that climbs you up the ladder of it, that keeps you going and whatever, is the natural competition we talked about when we talked on Tofop. I remember us talking about when we started at Elbow Grease, Jen Wood's room.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was, like, you know, 10 sort of household names today, who were all open micers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you would definitely be inspired by the fact that you're going, well, Hughesy's got five new minutes here. Next week when I'm on, I want to have five new minutes.
I think that is healthy. It's actually healthy to watch other comedians and then be inspired by their work. That's healthy. I don't think that's... And it might be competitive, but that's fine. Because that means, yeah, I've you know, you've got to work hard, and that's fine. But what's not healthy is comparing your ticket sales to other people's ticket sales and either feeling, you know, superior or inferior. That's just unhealthy. And what you've got to remember, and I really try to do that, is just you're doing it. You're literally, and it sounds corny, but you're doing it because you love it. Right. I love making people laugh. I love it more than anything else.
I love this job, so why am I bringing all these other things into it that are going to make me unhappy about it?
Yeah, well,
that don't matter.
Part of the reason to give up the phone is that, you know, but it's also that constant. Even, for example, the TV show I'm doing, I'm getting a lot of positive, you know, internet feedback about it, but you realize it's insatiable. Once you start looking for it, you need to keep looking for it, and then you think about, what about if it's not there? Like, it's actually unhealthy. To getting all that positive feedback is still unhealthy because you start to need it, and it's like a bottomless pit that you can never fill. When you're constantly looking for positive feedback, you can never fill that. You need to just... You really need to throw it away and focus on the fact you love what you're doing.
It also sometimes can be in the same way as, you know, you said that joke in your set became your favourite joke because Lee Mack said it was your favourite joke. Lee Mack probably has great taste and it probably was a great joke. And that, you know, it was probably good that it became your favourite joke and you leaned into it. But you don't know that the dude with the machine gun avatar is giving you the best feedback, you know, even if it's positive. Even if Machine Gun Avatar said, you know what, I love that joke about blah, 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 and you're like, okay, well, that's great. We should be doing more of that.
Yeah.
That might not necessarily be
good feedback. You really need to, I like what you're doing in your, you know, house at the moment where you don't have a TV or the internet. It
is going to happen at some stage.
Does it? It looks like, you know, you've been robbed, but... That minimalist.
But they left the podcast. They went, I don't need this hassle. I don't need this money wastage and time wastage hassle.
I love it. Oh God, people can only see this house. It's funny. There's nothing in it. There's nothing in Will's house. He's very simple. And I like that. I really like that.
Well,
strip it away.
It's been because Amy, you know, when she comes down, she's a production designer by trade.
She needs a blank canvas.
There's no point going out and buying shit that...
She will throw away.
I've learned over the time that we have known each other, Dave, that I've bought 3 separate kettles, none of which she was happy with. So I'm like, I'm not buying a kettle until she can buy the kettle.
My wife, when we moved in together, made me get rid of this German leather couch, which was big and black and the most comfortable couch I've ever had in my life. She made it. She said, I don't like the look of it. We've got to get rid of it. And I gave it to my sister, and my sister and brother-in-law have still got that couch. This is like 15 years at least later. Oh no, almost 15 years later. And whenever I go to their house and sit on that couch, I just think, why did I why did I get rid of this couch? It's the best couch in the history of the world.
Do you have a home office? That's why I have my home office. This is where I'm going to, you know, if you looked in that cupboard over there, you'd see a lot of Western Bulldog scarves. the stuff that I'm not allowed in the house.
No. Yeah, my wife, she hates football memorabilia. She hates sporting memorabilia. She hates sport, to be honest. So, I can't remember the question. What were we talking about?
but the idea of growing older in comedy and how your relationship with... I mean, for me, I stopped... one of the things I stopped doing during Gruen was reading... I don't read social media at all, like...
fair enough.
Gruen. Good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a necessary part of the process. But what that taught me was... that social media can be a place that you can still broadcast something. Like for me, the thing is
you can
this.
Broadcast without having to worry about the feedback. Is that what you're talking about?
So this is the difference between when I know I'm being healthy and when I'm not being healthy. Fine to put up a tweet, fine to put up a Facebook message. If I then go back at some stage
and read
to
all
see,
the comments,
or just to see, you know, how many retweets it's got or whatever, then it's about ego.
Yeah,
then
absolutely.
It's not about what you were putting out.
Oh God,
there.
Yeah, mate. I've been fishing on Tuesday nights. I'm getting a lot of compliments, but then fishing for more. And then, I mean, I have said I'll retweet anyone who says something positive. So, I mean, that's an incentive to say something positive about what I do. I won't deny that. But you know, when you're like 1 o'clock in the morning and looking at your phone, I think Perth's about to watch the show. Oh, bloody, you know, try to get some stuff going on there. Perth, show's on, say something nice. It's just too much.
Tell me what it's like hosting your own show. Like, I mean, obviously, you're a person who's host. I mean, you've had an amazing solo career as a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, had the radio show with Kate in all its various forms over. How long is it since you guys started working together?
That started the same time as The Glass House, really. So, since 2001, late 2001. Yeah, right.
So, like 16, 17 years, right?
Yeah.
So, and you've done every TV show there is out there.
I've been TV for all that time. There are many
but
shows.
You haven't really
been
had...
the one solo host of a TV show, right? No, I haven't. No, absolutely.
Been at the reins of your own thing. So what's... Yeah. A, was that something that you were craving to do?
And... Look, I mean, as you know, you know, it's easier to be on the side chipping in rather than being the host. I mean, you know, you were the host of The Glass House and I was on the side, and it was easier for me to do that because you can just sort of be funny and not have to worry about everyone else being funny, if you know what I mean. So, but when you're the host, and as you know, you want everyone to have their best time. So, and that is a big difference of like wanting, when you're on the side of a show, part of your ego, which is unhealthy and absolutely admit it's unhealthy, you want to be the funniest person on that panel. But when you're the host, you want everyone to be the funniest people they can be. You know, I don't want to be the funniest really, which is weird for me to say, you know what I mean? I want everyone, and when people come up to me in the street and say, I loved so-and-so on your show, I love so-and-so on your show, I literally take that as a compliment for me, you know, which is so different to when, you know, you're a panel member on Have You Been Paying Attention or, you know, or whatever other show over the years that I've been on. So, and I've really enjoyed that. You know, I've really enjoying everyone's laughs, you know, and
I think you'll find, like, the feedback I always think is that the only time you're counting jokes is when a thing's not working.
You know,
like if a thing's working, everyone's funny.
Yes.
And you know, the way that your show's been working, and it has been a fantastic success. And I think that, you know, across the board, people have been just really enjoying it. You know,
yeah,
you've had great talent on whatever.
We'll get you on eventually.
But
I mean, we wanted to get Will on, but he had his back issues.
I did have my back issue. I couldn't sit down at the time.
Yes, no, fair enough. Yep,
and you had no desk for me to hide behind. I was like, I could have sat down behind something that I could shift awkwardly behind, but you're like, nah,
can't do that. Yeah.
But the thing about it is that I think the general vibe of the show tends to be that thing of going, this is a funny show.
Yeah, and it's
like
a team
everyone's
game.
Everyone's funny on it.
You want it to be a team game, and that's the best thing. When you do stand-up comedy on your own, so it's only you getting laughs, but you really do. When I'm on a panel show, I want it to be a team game. I want it, you know, you want everyone setting each other up, and you know the best laughs will come not from you dropping a bit of your stand-up into the show, even though that might make the highlight reel or whatever. But the best bits will be when the interaction between, you know, different people on the show and it goes somewhere where no one thought it was going to go. So yeah.
Hmm. What do you know about comedy now that you wish you had known when you started doing comedy?
I think it's. I mean, I've always sort of known it, but you forget it, is to just not take yourself seriously. You've got to keep remembering not to take yourself seriously. Like, even the other day, doing two episodes of a TV show, you know, very little sleep, got you on set for hours, could do two in a row. It's like you're filming for bloody up to 6 hours and you've done 2 hours of rehearsal before that. But as I said to myself as I'm walking in, don't lose your sense of humour. Do not lose your sense of humour in any situation. And I still do sometimes, and it embarrasses me. And we all do, because we all have our moments.
Yeah.
You know, there's no doubt. And I still have my moments. I have, you know, but less and less, I reckon. But I still have them. But keep your sense of humour, you know. And as I say to anyone starting out comedy, remember, you're doing it because you think life's funny. Do not take yourself too seriously here. Work hard, but remember to laugh as you do it.
Do you think that comedians in general can be guilty of, this is a very leading question, but I believe, myself included, myself being a prime example of this, but I think that sensitivity to criticism for people who belt out criticism on a daily basis of others is something that is a fair judgment of people to make of comedians, that we are thin-skinned for people who are so...
able
to make fun of everybody else.
I know we are. So yeah, and I think, you know, and I make fun of that as well. You try to make fun of the fact that you're thin-skinned, you know.
Right.
God, I was on Gogglebox a couple of weeks ago, and someone said, one of the women on it said I was one of the ugliest guys I've ever seen.
I remember that,
and it broke my heart. I didn't know until I was on my. It's actually that will be on my TV show next week. because it's become a bit, you know, everything becomes a bit. So, but I only found out about it when I was in bed checking my phone, which I'm not doing anymore, but checking my phone at like 11:30 at night. And the person who'd said it, one of the goggle boxes, I didn't really know it. I appreciate the show, but I don't really watch it. But she said, "I'm sorry that calling." She sent me a message, a public message, but to me, "I'm sorry I called you one of the ugliest fuckers I've ever seen. You're not that bad," or something like that. It was like, but she didn't even say, "I didn't mean it." She just said, "I'm sorry for saying it. You're really funny." I'm saying, and I took, I was like, I was lying.
Didn't even take it back.
No, I was lying next to my wife and I'm like, "Oh God." And it took me a while. I swear to God, I drafted about probably 5 replies without sending them. So, but it was like, yeah, it was like, and then I talk about it the next day on the radio. I felt embarrassed talking about it.
Well, I remember, so that's, I hadn't seen that episode of Gogglebox at that stage.
Yeah.
But we watch it most weeks. Amy really loves it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we tend to watch it when it's on Channel 10. It goes to air
on
first
the Thursday.
On,
yeah. When, for, this was Wednesday night. So it had
been
on Lifestyle.
So this
would
have been the Foxtel version,
Foxtel,
right?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So we, yeah. So the order I saw it was, I heard you on the radio talk about it. Then I saw it, knew it was coming I watched it that night.
Yeah.
But Amy thinks it's hilarious because I actually really quite like Gogglebox. It's one of those shows where I'm like, I thought it was going to be a really terrible show and I couldn't believe that we had a TV show about watching. Yeah. And then you're like, this is actually
good fun.
Good fun and not a bad way to get a little insight into a whole bunch of shows I don't watch as
well. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's packaged together well. It's kind of fun.
It's doing really well. It's a great success for Channel 10 and Foxtel.
But Gruen will come up at least twice a season, most seasons.
Oh, yeah, right.
They'll have a Gruen one. And there's a standard formula to it, which is they'll start by, you know, people going, "Oh, I don't know if I like this show." And then at the end, like essentially they're laughing at something or enjoying something, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
I can't watch it. Like, yeah, exactly. I like Gogglebox, but the minute they start, like, Amy's like, "They did a good one on Gruen last night." I'm like, "Nah,
I know, because someone will say something that will break your heart.
Whatever it'll be.
Apparently they did it again the other night. Someone tweeted me they did it the other night and they were all really positive about the show again. I think they felt bad about the first one. But that, I mean, but again, that's criticism. My sister's like, "I'm never watching that show again." But look, but you know what? I get a bit out of it. I get like anything that is insulting to me becomes comedy. So in the end of the day, everything that is, you know, is hurt your feelings becomes a bit.
Is
and that's the beauty
there,
of
has your idea of what is on and off limits changed? You know, is everything up for grabs, you know, in your world and your life, or is there sort of things that you have, because people would imagine, I think, that you are as honest as anyone is, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You'll get your wife or your kids on the radio to relay the incident or the story whatever. So I think people would look at you and go, well, if anyone's telling us, you know, everything that happens, it's probably Husey, right?
Yeah, well, not every. You're not going to get everything, But I mean, you try to push the limits of what's possible. But, you know, I mean, obviously, my wife will say occasionally, "You cannot talk about that." And I don't, because I don't want to, you know, her to not like me, basically. Yeah. But she's very good. So we've got a relationship where, her embarrassment factor is really, you know, she's got she allows most things, which is great. So, and that's, it makes it. I went out with a girl before, Holly, who, she was a bit more sensitive about what was said about her on, you know, radio and stuff. So, I've had a few. I used to do a Saturday morning show on Triple M, and I remember coming home. I got a new pair of shoes, and on radio on the Saturday morning show on Triple M, I'd said, you know, basically it was intimated that because it was a pretty, you know, a shoe salesman is why I bought the shoes. And so I got home to our house and she opened the front door, looked down at my shoes and just saw the new shoes and I think she almost tried to attack me. But it was there. So it was like, she didn't get the joke. You know? She didn't appreciate that I'd bought these shoes because it was a pretty salesperson. That wasn't good for her apparently. So yes. And yeah, so that could be tricky. That was tricky.
when you're putting together a new show for Melbourne, do you start with sort of aims and aspirations for what it might be, or do you just like start?
And I still do, and anyone sees me, it's a grab bag what I do, you know, and you make it as current as possible. And look, there could be an old bit get in there, you know, I'm not going to deny that, but no one ever says to me that was the same show I've seen before. So it's absolutely fluid what I do. So yeah, but hopefully there'll be bits from today, like, or from tomorrow. So I never walk on stage with the show set ever, and so I'll be like, I literally won't know what bit's coming next. And so I will wander around in my mind and with the set. So it'll all, every show will be slightly different and sometimes stressful. But yeah.
Why like that?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. And it's like, you know what? When I had, there was times where I didn't do much stand-up back in the day when I was doing full-on breakfast radio and, you know, the Glass House. And I had those two things. And I wasn't doing much stand-up. And I had some shows which were just really stressful at Melbourne. Like, and this was the start when I was really selling a lot of tickets.
Right.
No, I would still sell tickets, but this was like, you know, that initial rush of doing the main town hall.
The problem is that, like, you get all the, you know, sort of success at the exact same time that you're too busy to concentrate.
I know. I remember once, and this is the most worst stand-up experience of my life, I reckon, where I've walked out on stage and the show was titled Massive. And it was like, this was before, you know, before you did the town hall, before many comedians were doing big venues.
Yeah, no, so it was like a big, it was a big, big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm doing the main stage of the town hall with no preparation, and I had not worked up material in smaller clubs, and I walked on stage with a half-assed idea of what I was going to do. I was so stressed. It was a full, like, you know, 1,500 people, whatever it is there. And the first joke, I can't remember what it was fucking tanked. And I did about three or four jokes that tanked and in front of 1,500 people. And that room can be cold.
Well, it's a room that you need to take a show that is already at its best. It's not a room that you can work in your material.
So I remember, you know, and I fucking panicked. And I'm like, I was having the worst time of my entire life. Like, I was there in a room, which should be the biggest success of my life. And I was having the worst time of my life. I wanted to kill myself on stage, 10 minutes in to an hour show. And I got off stage. I ended up doing old material. And I got off stage and I felt the worst I've ever felt. I could not leave backstage until about an hour or an hour and a half after the show because I did not want to run into one person who had been at that show. And I'm sure a lot of people enjoyed the show, but I was just mortified. After that, from that next year on, I thought, you've got to work on this. You cannot not work on your show. So
I remember I had a show at the Sydney Opera House, and it was in one of those, like, you know, when I was first coming up, and it was in one of those smaller rooms that are made for musicians so that they suck the sound into the walls.
Right, yeah,
They're literally made so that you can't hear the audience's noise, so that, like, you know, someone can be playing a violin and when somebody sneezes or coughs, it doesn't affect the performance.
Yeah.
And you're doing stand up in one of those rooms.
Oh, God.
So it's fair to say I wasn't getting the vibe from the audience that I would have hoped. And they were having, it was opening night, and they were having a little drinks thing that they'd thrown upstairs.
Yeah.
And I couldn't go to it. I was like, I said, I can't go. It was just, I can't go and, like, pretend, like, have people say to me that was all right or whatever. And so I'm in my car, like, down under the Opera House, like, and I'm crying in my car.
Yeah.
And our manager, Kevin, who, you know, has managed both of us for, you know, 20
many years.
Who's not, it's fair to say, a natural hugger,
not
a human affection person. And I still remember hugging.
Yeah.
And I still remember that's how desperate I must have been that he came in and hugged me. I was like, if I want to talk about what when you bottom out, when you're at absolute zero, is when Kev feels like he needs to hug you. You know,
it's just hilarious that you advertise yourself as a comedian and you're going to make everyone happy, and internally you just want to die. You just want to be anywhere but where you are. You hate the world, and then you've got to plow through another 30 minutes or whatever. Yeah.
What is it about a job? So this is interesting to me, because in a lot of other careers, if you were this far into it and you had the level of, you know, and by the way, this is just like, In any industry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you had the same sort of milestones and touchstones that we had in our industry, you'd be, like, when you went to work, you'd probably know what you were doing. Like, whereas we still put ourselves through this process of, like, there's a couple of bits in my show that I'm still just like, quite, you know, you're like, well, why am I putting myself through this idea that I'm going back to, like, what is it about that idea of that you are putting yourself in a position where some nights you will walk home from it and go, I feel terrible.
Well, I think
I'm the only person who has done this to myself.
Well, I imagine, I'm not completely sure, but I think probably the fact that it still can flatline, you can still have a shocking gig, actually probably gives you that joy, the continued joy for when it isn't like that. So I think it's good to be able to, even though it hurts when it happens, it's good to be able to remember that, you know, what you're doing is actually, you know, I'm not going to say amazing, but it's pretty special, you know. So what you're doing to a room full of people. I remember the first time I really made a room full of people crack up, I really had that thought that what I'm doing is making those people, that group of strangers, make noises out of their mouth. And I'm making them happy. I'm making a group of people I don't know happy. What a wonderful thing to do.
But not just a group of people, but a group of people who may not have anything else in common.
Yes.
Like, we live in a world at the moment where it's very easy for us every day for us to talk about what makes us different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what we don't like in other people and whatever.
Yeah.
But the idea that you have a capacity, at least for an hour, to get a room full of strangers who might not ever talk to each other at a barbecue or sit next to each other on a train, all agree, because that's what comedy is, right?
Yes, it is.
You're going, I agree. Like, my laughter is that I recognize that, or I see that to be true,
absolutely.
Or I agree with your, and they're all doing it together. So these people who may have nothing else in common have been brought together in enjoying that same moment. There is something wonderful about that.
You know what, you're inspiring me just through that, what you just said there, is of everyone recognizing the human experience is universal and it's okay to laugh at it, you know, together. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
We should finish up because, you know, we both are busy people and it's Melbourne Comedy Festival week. But I do want to ask you, because I always ask people in this podcast about these things. What do you think happens when you die? Do you think about it?
I do. Absolutely. I do. You know, I do think, it's, I've got no idea, but, I think it'll be peaceful. Yeah, I don't know. In general, I think humans don't appreciate the fact that they are alive enough. We don't appreciate the fact that we can breathe, that we can think, that we can move, or, you know, whether you can or not. But you don't appreciate, life enough. So we need to do that first before we think about what happens when we die. But
there's a little bit of you don't appreciate what you have until it's gone.
Yes.
So I couldn't sit down for 3 months last year.
Yeah, right.
And I just didn't realize how much now every time I sit down, I just enjoy it. I'm like, sitting down's pretty good. up until that point, I never really thought about how good being able to sit down is.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you can't sit down for a meal or to watch a movie or whatever, then next time you go to the movies, when you can, you're like, how good's been at the movies?
Yeah.
Sitting down, watching a movie.
Yeah, to broaden that out, I don't think we appreciate being alive enough.
Yeah.
So, what happens when we die? I don't know, but I think that it'll be peaceful.
You don't have an idea of, do you believe that you're dead and then that's it?
I don't think so. I think that
don't know.
Yeah, I rarely think about it, but I can only imagine that your energy will go somewhere and that, it's awe-inspiring even thinking about it. I'm really getting tingly thinking about it's something you don't contemplate very often. And it's when you've got children, you've got to try to explain to them what you don't know. I'd say to my kids, life's a mystery, just enjoy it, you know, and death's a mystery as well, enjoy that. So, yeah.
That's a really interesting perspective. One of the things that you did on the radio recently, which I thought was just amazing radio, and people can download the podcast using Kate and find this, I'm sure. And I know you talked about it came out of something you talked about on the TV show, which is, you talked about your dad, and then you were contacted by a nurse who'd... talked about the idea that the two of you didn't say,
we didn't really get on. We didn't see eye to eye. It's like the Mike and the Mechanic song. But I've actually listened to that song, and he really wanted to tell his dad that dad was an arsehole. If you listen, I heard it the other day, and I thought he's probably glad he didn't say it to him, because he basically just wanted to have a go at his dad the whole time. So, if you get to, you know what the living is, get the lyrics. He's basically wanted to say, I don't like your dad. So,
I don't like your dad, and I'm sad you died before I could get this off my chest.
I swear to God, those lyrics are like that. But
the film clip's just the lead singer Mike from Mike and the Mechanics pissing on his dad's grave.
Yeah, but a nurse sent me a message, a direct message on Instagram, I think it was, saying that she nursed dad in his final days, and that he was
But people can listen to the radio
very proud of his family.
And the way that you reading the letter or attempting to read the letter is, it's genuinely...
I swear to God, I can't even talk about it now. It's weird. But yes, it was a lovely message for that nurse to send. My dad was proud of his family. It was lovely.
Mm. Right. I can see even now.
I know. It's
despite
weird.
The fact that you've
that
talked about it so much.
Yes, it's weird. It's a weird one. It really got to me. So, yes, it was, that was a lovely thing that social media had done, you know? For all the negativity that can happen on social media, that was for someone to be able to send that message. And and I showed it to Mum and she was crying. And it was, you know, in the messages, he talked about how much he loved his wife. And it was lovely.
Does that make you think about the way that you are with your family?
Yeah, it does. And I really, I want to instill in my children that life is fun, you know, and that's it, that life is fun. And, you know, we're not judgmental at home and don't judge other people, you know, really, you know, and just, you know, laugh at everything. And I really want them to be able to laugh at themselves as well. So, and that's, you know, that's what, they enter my routine a lot and they, you know, I tell them, you when you said that, I've made that a joke, you know, and they enjoy that. So yeah, that's one thing I want my children, whatever they do in their life, they can, whatever, it doesn't matter. If they think life is fun, and they're able to laugh at themselves, and that's what I want them to be able to do.
Now, there is a case at the moment of a woman who's being sued by her ex-husband because she did a show about their divorce and relationship. And
we're trying to get her on the radio, actually.
Yeah, he's now suing her.
Yes.
So I just would say get those kids to sign some release forms. If you could just get Kev to knock up some release forms, get the kids to sign them.
It's a real incentive for me to stay with Holly as well, so... If we got divorced and then she, like Stefanovic, like, and then she's, and you can't joke about the kids either, that would be, no, we were staying together.
Yeah, I lost the kids in the divorce. Access to them, no, just the material, but that's worse. I still see them on weekends and they're doing so much funny stuff that I can't
mention
talk
it.
About.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Hughesy, tell us about the comedy festival this year. You're at the Athenaeum.
Yeah, Athenaeum.
You love the Ath, right?
I do love that. I know that you're... Comedy theatre, which is a beautiful theatre, and we've worked there together. But the Ath for me is dingy. I mean, the backstage is dingy, and it's just, I just love the feel of it. It's a beautiful old theatre, and, you know, it doesn't have to be completely full. Like, the comedy doesn't happen, I'm sure it is every night for you, but, you know, not every night is completely full.
No,
but
we're doing four weeks.
We're doing a month, yeah, absolutely.
We're doing 4 weeks in 1,000-seat theatres. If it's not fucking completely full every fucking night, then calm down. Hold your horses.
I know, absolutely. So it's a beautiful theatre.
Remember the first time that, like, this would have been you playing the Town Hall, probably.
Yeah,
the first time that probably anyone of our generation played a 1,000-seat venue.
Yeah.
We were like, and that's 1,500 or whatever it is.
Yeah,
like, we were like losing our minds.
Oh, mate.
And now, if we don't sell out our 20 nights there, we're like, what's going on?
I remember seeing you at the Prince's Theatre and you had like, I don't know, 800 people on a Wednesday, maybe 1,000 people on a Wednesday night, the Prince's Theatre. And I was like, he's on for a month. Wednesday night? What the hell's going on here? This place is full. My God. Yeah. So, you know, we're very lucky. And
The new show is called The Snorkeler.
Yeah. So
is there any snorkeling based?
There's a little bit of snorkeling based. It's a routine I've been doing for a couple of years, but it resonates with people. And it's about the fact that my friends down in Warrnambool were surfers. I was a snorkeler and they got more attention. Snorkelers aren't appreciated. Anyway, it's funny thing about that is that my two daughters, my 5-year-old and 6-year-old, the other morning were eating their rice bubbles, and my 5-year-old, just out of the blue, because obviously the posters have been around Melbourne, so her mother, my wife, had explained to her, that's Daddy's show, and my 5-year-old said, Daddy, you should have been a surfer, not a snorkeler. And I'm like, and then her 6-year-old sister just looked at me and said, Dad, you're a loser.
And you're obviously, like, kids, I have signed these consent forms because that's going in the show.
And it has. And obviously, my wife hasn't explained the rest of the routine about what a snorkeler boyfriend could do for women. Anyway, thank God she hasn't explained it.
I mean,
wouldn't be put it beyond her, honestly. My son knows about the facts of life at the age of 7. God almighty. Anyway, there's a routine there. Come to see the show.
And, of course, your television show, Hughesy, We Have a Problem. You can catch all the old episodes on 10Play, and it got extended. So
we're having a run of 16 episodes. We're in the middle of filming the second 8. So, yeah, it's at 8:30. First run's 8:30 on a Tuesday night.
That's a fantastic show. Mate, thank you so much. Oh, Hughesy and Kate.
On 4:30 every afternoon on the Hit Network
right
around the country.
Australia,
yeah,
right?
All regionals as well, which is great.
And
so,
if you are, I've been listening to it on the, I listen listen to the podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you can get that from all over the world. So if you're listening to this anywhere in the world and you want to check out Hughesy and Kate, they have a podcast every day. It's about 40 minutes of the... Yeah, 40 minutes to an hour of the best bits of the show. So it's a great way to listen if you're in the country.
Kate's an absolute superstar. So, yeah, it's great.
Well, I was going to talk to you about Kate, but I think we'll save that for another time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'd love to talk about the idea of maintaining a professional relationship with somebody, you know,
for that long.
And in that way, I think it's a really fascinating topic. But we'll save that for next time. We'll hook them through.
Get her on, mate.
I definitely would like to get her on.
But she's hard. She doesn't want to work as much as I do. She's probably smart.
I don't think anyone wants to work as much as you do, mate.
No, you do.
Thank you. I don't think anybody outside this room wants to work as hard as either of us do.
Good on you, mate. I love your podcast.
Thanks, mate. Well, I appreciate it.